This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Over the past two decades, author and journalist Dave Eggers has written more than a dozen books, from a critically acclaimed memoir to a dystopian tech saga. Eggers is a native of Illinois and went to the journalism school at the University of Illinois in Urbana. He also founded the national tutoring nonprofit 826 Valencia and started the literary magazine and humor website McSweeney's. His latest book is The Captain and the Glory, an allegory about the current American political scene. I spoke with Eggers in December, which is when we first broadcast this interview. As you're listening, keep in mind that impeachment was in the news, the pandemic was not. Eggers also had been attending Trump rallies since 2016, and some of those experiences are reflected in the novella. Dave Eggers, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So your latest book is called The Captain and the Glory. I've heard it referred to as a satire, an allegory. It's about a ship run as a democracy that decides to replace a beloved experienced captain with someone whom, as you write, all the passengers knew to be clownish and not the least bit qualified. How did this book come about?
Well, it might sound like it has parallels to our political moment and who we elected to the White House a few years ago. Those are just purely circumstantial. There's no direct reference implied.
I think your copyright page, which I've always learned to read since your first book many years ago, but it says, any resemblance to nefarious public officials responsible for the suffering of countless innocents is entirely metaphorical.
I forgot I wrote that. Yeah, I I've been covering the Trump era as a journalist, and most recently I was at the rally in Hershey, Pennsylvania, the day that the articles of impeachment were handed down. And I learned so much by meeting Trump voters and trying to cover it soberly and really listen to people. And I always come away edified, and I come away my faith in people restored when you really listen to their reasoning. And but then at the same time, I take a few steps back every week, and I, see the towering absurdity of the last 3 years and what we're going through as a country. And so I thought, in addition to covering it journalistically, I thought it might be appropriate satire, and a sort of an allegorical satire might be the best way to really match the bizarreness and really capture the truth of it in a way that sort of straight-up journalism really can't.
Yeah, you talked about going to the rally. And in my day job, I'm a political reporter myself, so I, too, have talked to Trump supporters. And they seem, not the cartoon that is often portrayed, I think. And I wonder, how did you want them to come across in the book? Because it felt sympathetic at times and then definitely not so much at other times.
Yeah, I think, I always have the best conversations with voters on either side, but especially at these rallies. I learned so much, and they're always reasonable and always have very understandable reasons, I think, for supporting Trump, and also very narrow reasons. Like, this most recent rally, somebody said, there's $2,500 more in my pocket this year than last year, and that's just hard to debate. When, their 401ks are growing, all of these sort of pocketbook issues that are really sort of hard to argue with. And so, but at the same time, at the rallies and in general, there's kind of a glee that I think can get very ugly and I think very disturbing, the glee with which they as a group, when you see 11,000 people sort of chanting, "Lock her up," or 11,000 people cheering, the building of the wall, or, some of these sort of more punitive and ungenerous policies. I think that I wanted to capture that too. So in the book, there's a group of supporters that call themselves the most foul, because somebody had said, why would we support a candidate who is, the most foul of anybody on board the ship. So they adopt that, they co-opt it, they call themselves the most foul, and they dress in chicken costumes. And I thought that there's a little bit of a parallel there, because as reasonable individually, as so many Trump voters are, collectively they can create a real sort of a sometimes insensitive and menacing and atmosphere for anyone that sort of doesn't conform to their worldview. And so, again, I had to heighten things here and maybe exaggerate a bit to sort of capture what I think is the true impact. Not necessarily, you know, get into the subtleties and the nuance of it, but heighten it a bit because the power of Trump's words and the power of the ideology and the power of his so-called movement is one very often of menace, very often of fear, and very often one that creates an uncomfortable environment for tens of millions of people in this country, especially those people who might be considered, other, you know, people of color, immigrants, children of immigrants, all of these groups that Trump has explicitly or implicitly threatened.
Certain people in your book, CP.
Certain people.
Yeah. And the captain's choices about how he deals with those certain people do make even some of the most foul, the supporters of the captain in your book, uncomfortable. But at least he's something different, right? You see the phrase, he's shaking things up. And I wonder, is that something you still hear from supporters of
Absolutely.
The president?
You know what was weird is the last guy I interviewed, second to last guy I interviewed in Hershey, Pennsylvania, he was wearing a Santa hat that said, Make America Great. He had Trump buttons top to bottom. But he was really eloquent and, you know, really talkative and open and, you know, thoughtful. And he thought that Hillary Clinton was a crook. He thought the Bidens were crooks. I mean, a lot of this stuff was very fed, you know, what you'd expect, sort of Fox News tropes. But then, you know, he liked Trump because he talked straight and all of these things that we hear, that he talks straight and that he's a disruptor. And then 17 minutes into this conversation, because I looked down at my tape, and it was 17 minutes in that he revealed that he voted for Obama twice, 2008 and 2012, and he even worked for Obama in 2008. And what was important to him was the purity of conviction, that Obama was an honest guy who told it straight, who, you know, came out of nowhere, had new ideas, and had a certain purity about him. He didn't have a checkered past, I guess, were in this voter's eyes. And Trump, in the same way, felt to him like the same kind of person, a disruptor, somebody new, somebody not tainted by the politics of Washington. And so for him, the Romneys, Clintons, and Bidens are not appealing because they seem corrupted, and the Trumps and the Obamas are in a different category as coming from outside that system and therefore more appealing, more pure. So it's a very interesting algorithm that he's going by. But you hear it again and again. A lot of Obama voters became Trump voters.
Yeah, and people used to say that President Obama was the first Twitter president. Now, I think that is kind of a quaint notion.
Yeah, not at all. They said he was the first internet president and the first Twitter president, but he was still conforming to very established norms about having his messages looked over by so many people, vetted by lawyers, et cetera, et cetera. So those communications were traditional presidential communications. They just happened to be delivered through this relatively new medium. But Trump is truly the first internet president because everything that nobody's looking at what he writes before it's delivered.
Right.
It's reactionary, it's misspelled, it's ludicrous, it's full of inaccuracies, it peddles in conspiracies, it's threatening, it's hate-filled, all of these things that, you know, occupy the darker corners of the internet and of Twitter. And so in that way, he most aptly mirrors the worst impulses made possible by social media.
Yeah, and I want to come back to social media, but while we're talking about the president and Twitter and the internet and how his supporters react to it, I don't know if candor is the right word, but it does feel like this matrix-like pipeline we have into his inner life. And I wonder, how did you think about the president as the internet as you were writing this book?
I think that that's the most interesting thing, is that even when his supporters acknowledge that he lies, first of all, they say all politicians lie. And so that's just excused very quickly. And then secondly, his candor when he tells lies makes him more truthful. And there's this pretzel logic that rules here, where it says if you speak candidly, off the cuff, without notes, whatever you say is implicitly more true than were you to read from a piece of paper or a teleprompter. So it's like, but it, I've seen and heard that said in dozens of ways, hundreds of times, that that's the appeal. And when I saw this last rally, I was on the floor with about 1,000 people on the floor, and there were 10,000 people in the stands, and he really does just talk off the cuff for an hour and 20 minutes in this case about, and it does feel like you are getting the completely unfiltered thoughts of a septuagenarian man with incredible power. And there is a thrill to that, that you can feel in the room, that you are just getting it straight. You're drinking from the fire hose. And no matter what he says that is unpresidential or untruthful, there is that incredible electric glee that goes through that audience, thinking like, wow, we really shouldn't be hearing this. This is so unprecedented. It's so undignified. It's so unrehearsed. And but there's that kind of naughty thrill, I guess, that you get from hearing somebody that really should not be speaking this way as president doing so. And at the same time, you know, he puts on a show for stretches at a time. It is incredibly entertaining, maybe in that sort of train wreck sort of way. You don't know what's going to happen next. But he really knows how to put on a show, and that's why so many tens of thousands of people come to these rallies, because A, they're free, and B, you know it's going to be a good show one way or the other.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with the writer Dave Eggers. His latest book is The Captain and the Glory. It's an allegory about the present situation in American politics, I'll say. I want to pause on our discussion of the book to talk about your youth. One of the reasons we wanted to have you on the 21st is that you are from Illinois, grew up in the Chicago suburbs. How do you think coming of age in the Midwest informed your creative life?
Well, you know, the Chicago suburbs, I don't know if there's any better place to grow up as a kid. So I feel very lucky to have been raised in that very comfortable, I mean, almost bubble-like atmosphere that we grew up in, where there was the lake and trees and valleys and, you know, we had a creek. I mean, it was a drainage ditch, but it was a creek running behind our house that we thought was the Mississippi.
Too.
Yeah. Lord knows what was in there and what kind of toxins were seeping into the water. But that said, you know, I'm very proud to have been from the Midwest. I do think that the Midwest grows very good people. And then I went to school downstate in Champaign-Urbana and for college and learned so much there, too, and got to meet people from every other part of the state. You know, I feel like it gives you a real bedrock set of values and an awareness of every walk of life, because there is every kind of person, even in, you know, the one state of Illinois. I met so many people from farming communities and so many people from you know, the western suburbs, the north suburbs, the middle of the state, the southern part of the state. I think I think I learned a lot more having gone to that big state school, where so many of my friends were working their way through. So many of my friends were in the National Guard and got called up during the first Iraq War. Then I would have, I don't know, I guess going to a small liberal arts college out east or something, where there can be a certain sameness of the people that go there, and there's a lot of wealth in it. Illinois, there was real socioeconomic diversity, and I wouldn't have traded it for the world.
So when you're going to school at the U of I, I gather a lot of your journalism training, and you did, we should say, if we didn't, train as a journalist, old school Chicago Tribune guys. Do you ever think about a version of your life where you I don't know, went to work for the News Gazette, worked your way up to the Tribune, and then take a buyout, laid off in the Great Recession, and you're now the vice president for corporate communications at a chain of hospitals or something?
Yeah, sure. No, I mean, well, I mean, I was an art major for my first couple of years. I wanted to be a painter, and I came into the Daily Illini, the daily paper there, as a cartoonist, really. Well, I mean, a photographer first. I used to shoot the Fighting Illini on the floor of, Assembly Hall. And then I was a cartoonist, editorial cartoonist, illustrator, then a feature writer, news writer, and then edited the monthly magazine. And I did every kind of job they would let me do there because there was no better education than the Daily Illini. Like, they treated us like professionals, and we worked for a professional paper that competed with the News Gazette, the adult-run paper. And we had no interference whatsoever editorially that I knew of. I only worked with other college students, and we put out a paper every day. And so it was incredibly thrilling and a real honor to be part of that. And I'm still in touch with so many people from the DI. But then, you know, right after college, you know, my parents died when I was a senior. And so I, you know, we had to move to everything was, you know, everything changed. And so I moved to California with my sister and little brother, and we started over. So that all of those decisions were kind of made for me about what was going to be next. And so, but I still, you know, in San Francisco, I started at working in the promotions department of the San Francisco Chronicle, and the editorial and cartooning I did for SF Weekly. And then when Salon started, I started at Salon. So I was working, again, like five different jobs to make ends meet, but I had a lot of good opportunities here in SF.
More to come from my December interview with author Dave Eggers, whose latest book is The Captain and the Glory. You're listening to The 21st. Stay with us. It's the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We've been revisiting my December conversation with novelist and journalist Dave Eggers, whose latest book, The Captain and the Glory, is an allegory about contemporary American politics. It's about a ship that replaces a beloved, experienced captain with someone who is none of those things, but the people say, at least he's shaking things up. Dave, I don't want to spoil the ending, but I put down your book feeling at least somewhat optimistic, right? The ship is not great, but there's mostly young people coming back. There's a sense that the glory might be redeemed. I wonder, was the book always going to take that course? Why did you
it? Yeah. I didn't know how it was going to end, to be honest. But, you know, this is a ship of a few thousand people, and they go through what I consider a fever, where they succumb to, I think, authoritarian tendencies. Their interest in disruption or shaking things up at all costs puts them all in incredible danger and risks the values that bind them and all the principles for which the glory, this boat, this ship stands. And then at the end, it's up to a group of small vessels that periodically come to the ship seeking solace and safety. They are the ones that have recovered all of these books of principles and traditions and rules and guidelines that the captain has thrown overboard over the past, during his tenure. And so they've been seeing these books floating on the water, and they say, did you lose these? Maybe you want these back. And so they're really, you know, refugees from all over the seas that find these books floating, take them in, and restore them to the glory. And so I came, you know, that ending sort of wrote itself in a way, because it does reflect how I believe. I do think that we will go back to our better selves, and whether Republican or Democrat, we will again, I think, come back to the belief that the White House should have a a certain dignity to it. The person that occupies it should be respectful of our Constitution, of our history, of Congress, of our intelligence gathering, of our allies, of international law, of teenage climate activists. You know, that person should be a dignified role model of, at least should be attempting to be so. And we've abandoned that belief. We really, no matter what part of the political spectrum you're on, you cannot say that the occupant of the White House is a role model in any aspect of his behavior. And I think that that is something that is really beyond debate. I don't think any tax cut is worth sacrificing our dignity as a nation.
I don't hear supporters say that either, that, you know, that he's a role model, even if they still support him and would vote for him again.
Yeah, I mean, I think all of his policies could be enacted by a dignified human on the Republican side, and we wouldn't have to deal with the constant embarrassment and shame and cruelty and excoriation of vulnerable peoples and bullying and all of these things that just are unacceptable from a head of state. And so, you know, I grew up in an independent household, a libertarian household. My older brother worked for George W. Bush. I know every part of the political spectrum, and I can really understand and talk to anybody. But this is something different. I just don't – the lack of honor and the incredibly base crudity and cruelty is just something that I don't find acceptable.
We've been speaking with Dave Eggers. His latest book is The Captain and the Glory. It's an allegory about American politics. Dave, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Brian. Good to talk to you.